to Michigan HockeyCast 6.24, where making the final weekend consistently is the mark of an elite program. Before we get into the depressing part of the HockeyCast, we need to talk about the absence of the HockeyCast, where we spent a long time recording a very detailed, thorough, and entertaining, I would say, HockeyCast last Monday. And then you got so mad at me that you went in and deleted it off the file and wouldn't allow me to post it. Is that fully correct as to what happened?
One of us committed serious crimes, and there was an admission of guilt in the file, so it had to be deleted.
Which one do you think that they will think committed the crimes?
It's up for them to decide.
Okay. Seriously, though, there was a recording issue, and we did not find out until late that night, and I think that I probably messed up part of the recording in... with either not double-checking or hitting button something. And so I wanted to tell everyone that you were really good and were spot-on on a lot of your analysis and totally nailed the BC stuff, despite it not being provable. But I wanted to give you credit, Alex, on this HockeyCast for what you did last week. And it's unfortunate that people will not be able to hear it. But if you are listening this week and I have not screwed up the recording, which those things seemingly would go hand in hand, then I assume you will do just as good a job this week. So now we can move into quite a bit of news. We're going to talk about a few things early on. You have one in particular, and I wanted to share an experience I had last week. Then we will talk about the game, unfortunately. And in the second segment, we have a rundown of a kind of a collaboration of lists of things that... can be discussed and that are mostly relevant
to
those.
We have a segment to burn, so we'll be jumping around.
It's more than a segment to burn. I mean, there's interesting tidbits in there that I would recommend sticking around for. Anyway, all right, so first thing that you wanted to talk about was the Utah Yeti.
Or Utah Mountaineers?
Is that what it's going to be?
Oh, no one knows.
What about Ski Patrol?
Utah Pioneers?
Probably not. I mean, maybe. I think Yeti is good.
Just seems a little cliche to me.
But there's not Yeti in Utah, are there? Well, isn't that more of like a snow
it's
northern?
It's kind of like a Utah Yeti. It's just, I don't know, it sounds like a cartoon character team.
Well, I mean, okay, but than the Kraken?
I kind of liked the idea of the Utah Saints to steal another New Orleans team. And so you have, obviously, the Latter-day Saints.
That's pretty good.
A good Mormon like... Ryan Smith is going to wade into the religion side.
But... Yeah, probably. But don't you think that the Yeti playing the Kraken is like the least NHL thing? Like if you brought back people from the 30s or 40s during the original six, and you're like, oh, the Western Conference Finals this year are between the Yeti and the Kraken when they would just commit Harry Carey?
It's all teams have to be mythical creatures now.
God.
That's the rule.
I think I would stop rooting for... things at that point.
The Arizona Coyotes are relocating. That's the news of the week.
Seems most likely anyway.
It seems very likely.
Has the ink dried?
They haven't closed the deal, but everyone involved in the deal wants it to be closed. So when that's the case...
So they're not going to be the Houston Solar Bears?
It just might take a little time because of... It's a very convoluted transaction. So
sure.
The lawyers are working very hard, but...
Is this because there are cameras in the
we'll see how
boardroom?
How they do, but... I think this is an interesting thing to talk about just because this is the first relocation in the NHL in 13 years. And
the Thrashers became the Jets.
Yep.
What was the one before that?
The Hurricanes.
Oh, yeah.
For the Whalers,
the Hurricanes. Whalers, the Hurricanes. That was a sad one.
Yeah. Because there were three right in a row. Nordiques to Colorado, followed by Jets to Phoenix, followed by Whalers to...
Yeah.
The Kings.
That was all within like 2 years
yep.
or something.
Yeah. 95, 96, 97. Right
okay.
In a row. But this one is interesting because for those of us born in the 90s and anybody that started watching the NHL.
Is that our clientele, by the way? The people born in the 90s?
We will say it is.
it fits your narrative.
And that started watching hockey early 2000s, around the time of the lockout, let's say.
All right.
This is wild And because Jay Fresh,
not Minnesota Wild.
Jay Fresh put out a tweet about this, and basically, like, he's a little bit older than me, but in this age range, this saga has gone on our entire lives watching the NHL. Like, as far as I can remember.
You mean the Coyotes?
The Coyotes have been on life support. Like, I remember as a little kid talking about they were going to move to Hamilton. And that was 15 years ago. Like, the Coyotes have been in crisis forever. And so for some of us, it's just surreal that it's finally ending. That this, like, one constant in the NHL was this team was always in trouble. And now, at long last, it's ending.
And what have they had? 2-3 good seasons, maybe? If that.
Yeah, something like that.
They made the conference finals, what, in 12?
2012.
And that was...
That's their one playoff round they won. Real playoff round. If you don't count the play.
Oh, the bubble. Oh, yeah. No, okay. But outside of that, they haven't won another playoff series except in 2012.
When they won two, correct.
Holy cow.
They were okay when they moved.
They made the playoffs.
Yeah, they had Jeremy Roenick and Keith Tkachuk and...
Oh, that's right.
Teppo Nummanen and Sean Burke and... They were okay. Like, they were in the playoffs. They'd lose every round.
Hobby Bulin?
Yeah, they might have had him after that. Yeah, so they lost to the Ducks, I know, in 7-1 year. They lost to a few teams. And then they were pretty bad for a while. That was, like, when Gretzky coached them.
Oh, yeah.
And
I went to a game in L.A. against the Coyotes when Gretzky was the coach. Isn't that kind of wild?
That's pretty fun.
Yeah. I took a picture of it, I think.
And then they had those three teams in the early 2010s that made the playoffs. They lost twice to the Red Wings. Mm. And then they beat Chicago and they beat Nashville. And then they lost to L.A. in the conference finals.
Was that close? I don't remember that. I mean,
they got swept or lost in five. I don't remember. But L.A. just steamrolled everyone that whole playoffs. But,
sure.
And that was mostly Mike Smith being... That was his... His greatest season. He was unreal that year. And that was like a bizarre team. Martin Hansel, Radim Verbata. Ray Whitney. Like, just a weird collection of players. And then since then, they've been really bad. And for about 10 years now. And all the while, the team was in huge business trouble.
Mm-hmm.
When they moved to Phoenix from Winnipeg, they played in America West Arena, which was the Suns Arena at the time.
Downtown.
It wasn't a good fit because it was a bad arena for hockey, so they needed to get a new one.
But they had fans, I think.
Yeah, they were decently supported in that little period. And it was fine. You could play there as long as you were getting a good arena. And they built a state-of-the-art arena. The problem was they built it in Glendale.
The Cardinals also moved out there, right?
Yeah, the problem is you're playing a lot more games. And you don't have as established foothold. And it just so happened that their season ticket holders and casual fans did not live close to Glendale. They lived in the opposite side.
Well, and it probably wasn't as booming a suburb as it became.
Yeah, and when you are a new team in a sport a lot of people are unfamiliar with, and then you play like 45 minutes away from where a lot of the people live, it's not a great combo. Because a lot of people are like, I don't know what hockey is, and do I want to drive 45 minutes to watch this bad team get crushed night after night?
Well, I think that's the biggest key, right? Is they were, I mean, had they been good, people would have found a way to go.
Probably, yes.
But they were never really good.
Right. And the move to Glendale was really what doomed the Coyotes. It began this death spiral that they never got out of, where the team was losing money on ice, which made the increasing debt made it so that new owners didn't want to buy the team, which meant that the people who did buy the team were increasingly shady businessmen who then ran up more debts, which then made it even harder to find a new owner. And so eventually they were owned by Jerry Moyes, a trucking magnate. He tried to sell the team to Jim Balsillie, the BlackBerry guy who wanted to move them to Hamilton. The league stopped that, intervened. The team was in bankruptcy court. The league owned them for 3 or 4 years. Then they were sold to a different group. And then finally to this group, which was led by Alex Maruelo, who the league liked. They liked that he was one guy and not a group of investors. They liked that he supposedly had deep pockets. The problem was he was a con man. And so over the past 4 or 5 years, it's just been continual problems. They got locked out of the arena briefly for not paying rent and then had to move to Mullet Arena in Tempe, which was sold as a thing to do while they were building a new arena. Problem was, Maruelo wasn't willing to put up the cash himself for a private arena.
It's also been like 3 or 4 years that they've been there now.
This is the second season, the end of the second season.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's only been 2 years. But it was married to the idea they were going to build an arena in Tempe, which was a great idea. Tempe's a lively place. It's right near downtown Phoenix. It would have worked. The problem was he wasn't willing to do it with his own money, so he wanted public money to do it. And as we know, in a lot of places, voters have increasingly become uninterested in giving billionaires free money to build stadiums.
With good reason.
And they got outspent in that campaign, which is crazy to me. When you're a pro sports team and you have a billionaire owner, to be outspent in a campaign you need to win.
Mm-hmm.
And they got defeated at the ballot box by a wide margin. And that was a year ago. And since then, I really believe there was not a way they were going to be able to stay. And the machinations, I guess, were going on behind the scenes. They were still talking about this land auction in North Phoenix that the Maruelo was going to try to buy, and they were going to build an arena and blah, blah, blah. But it just seemed like a long shot. And even if he won the auction and started building, the closest date they could open the arena was fall 2027, which was going to mean five total seasons in Mullet Arena. And the players' union just was not interested in that. The other owners, particularly those of rich teams that have been writing checks to keep this team alive, were not interested in that. And so about a month ago, Gary Bettman and Bill Daly met behind the scenes with Maruelo and told him it's time. And they have a prospective buyer, Ryan Smith, owner of the Utah Jazz and Real Salt Lake. He's a young up-and-coming owner, and he put in a bid, and I guess behind the scenes they've been working on it, and the details leaked out last week. And it really escalated real fast, but this is how the NHL operates. The Thrashers were not leaving, they were not leaving, they were not leaving. How dare you even suggest that they might leave? And then the moving trucks are rolling out of the driveway.
They're the Jets.
And that all happened real fast, and this one, same story. I mean, Wednesday of last week, it came out, the NHL's preparing a schedule for next season with the Coyotes in Utah and one where they're in Arizona. Isn't that interesting? Everyone's like, it's good to have a contingency plan. Then it comes out a little bit later, they're working on a deal to sell the team and move them. It's like, it's not a contingency plan. Then an hour after that, it comes out, by the way, if they get sold, they're getting sold next week. And it's like, what? What?
So one of the ramifications of this that I've heard is that there could potentially be realignment.
Which I don't get that, by the way.
And it would be, theoretically, Utah and Colorado
moving to the Pacific. And the Alberta team is moving.
Edmonton and Calgary moving to the Central. What do you think of that?
I just don't get that one, because I thought one of the perks of moving from Arizona to Utah is you didn't have to do realignment. You're not moving any more west. You're just moving north a little bit.
Do you think it's trying to just fix something anyway, or realign?
The argument, I guess, is they want to group Colorado, Vegas, and Utah together.
Oh, because they're all like close by?
I guess. The only thing to me that stands out about that is just, I don't know. I mean, that would create a crazy Pacific division and a deeply unserious Central division, which maybe they don't care about.
A crazy Pacific division because of...
Just in terms of my assessment of the competitive balance of the division.
Well, you'd have
because
Colorado, Vegas, and Vancouver that are all really good right now.
The Kings are still pretty good. And I think that the Coyotes are on the way up. And then you've got the Ducks, which maybe they'll figure it out one day. But they do have a lot of talent. And San Jose's is stockpiling talent as well. Whereas when I look at the Central...
Seattle. Also,
they're the punching bag, but
so you have three teams that are down, a couple in the middle, and three teams.
My point is that in the Central, then you look at that division and you're like, who here besides Edmonton is a serious team?
Is Dallas not?
Oh, Dallas. So those two.
Is Winnipeg not?
They're okay, but they're on the older side, and St. Louis is kind of on the way down, and Chicago. I think that would be by far the weakest division in the NHL.
Well, this year is the strongest. I mean, that stuff tends to be cyclical, though.
That is a fair point. So it's
but it seems like that trade is fair, because you'd have Edmonton for Colorado and you'd have Calgary for Arizona, Utah, whatever. I mean, those seem like teams in remotely similar spots.
Yeah, I think the difference is that in my assessment of it is just that you'd be trading that Arizona by moving to Utah and getting a real owner. Would be becoming a serious team, because the word is that the new owner is going to spend to the cap, which Right now, by the way, their active roster is only about 40 million. They spend about 25 million on players who do not play in the NHL anymore.
Because they're just trying to...
Yeah, it's a money laundering scheme.
Yeah,
and,
probably.
And the new owner is going to... I mean, they have 75 points. Like, you watch that team. They're well coached. They've got young players. And you now are suddenly going to add 30 million in payroll to the roster. Like, okay, now we're...
We're not trading at the deadline
every year. Yeah, we're a real team now. And Calgary's one of the least serious organizations in the NHL. So... Whoever's in a division with them is always happy to do that for me, just because they're one of those teams that quietly is like...
So would you just keep it the same?
For 30 years is like, our goal is to be the 8th seed in the playoffs.
So is Nashville. So
there you go. They're two in the same division.
And the Blues. Wow. Blues are better. Probably have a bit higher of a ceiling. But.
So, but I'm excited to see this team in Utah. We'll see what they're called. I think
Ski Patrol.
Yeah.
Come on.
It can create some fun rivalries with Vegas and Colorado, potentially.
Well, because there are in other sports, right? I mean, the Jazz and Nuggets kind of have a bit of a rivalry, and Real Salt Lake and the Rapids sort of have a bit of a rivalry, and they're sort of, they've tried to foster that.
You get the two
in the
skiing
old
states.
Pac-12 between Colorado and Utah.
Sure.
And so, I mean, like, you could do that. And
I think on paper... Salt Lake City makes sense as a hockey market.
I don't know. Maybe. What sort of hockey history do they have?
Well, they don't have a ton. They have the Utah Grizzlies, who are an ECHL team, and they had the Salt Lake Golden Eagles back in the day, who were a good minor league team in several leagues. But my point is that if we're just diagnosing cities on paper that have no real history, what ones do you think would make sense? And this one makes sense in my mind, because for one... This isn't like we're putting a team in Boise and praying. Like, we have a proof of concept. The Jazz have sold out almost 300 straight games. Like,
sure.
The fans there do show up for pro sports.
But basketball's a little more...
It's established there. I get that.
No, not there. I would say that it's more... Hockey's much more of a niche sport.
Sure, but my point on that is this is a place that has a significant tourism industry based around winter sports. A number of
That's
people
fair.
There ski in snow. It gets snow.
Yeah.
It hosted the Winter Olympics before and plans to host them in 2034.
Yeah.
From that perspective, plus you have the fact it's a pretty affluent metro area. So if the team caught on, you could see hockey grow there quite a bit. Build more rinks, get youth players involved, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, weirdly, that's kind of what happened in Arizona.
That's the miracle of the Coyotes.
It got the grassroots program going and
it's
took
crazy
off.
Because you have a team like Carolina who's been there a long time and they did win a Stanley Cup and have been good the last number of years. And Arizona has way outdeveloped Carolina or Atlanta ever did in terms of grassroots hockey engagement.
Yeah.
And so the hope is, and the league does plan to go back to Arizona one day and...
That's what we need. We need more expansion.
And my thing is that if they plan to go back there, the league has a responsibility to me to keep funding these programs that the Coyotes funded, because
you mean in
Arizona,
right? I mean, so yeah,
the league spent how many years trying to keep this franchise alive? How much money did they spend trying to keep this franchise alive? And to me, if you up and move and then just let the only good thing the Coyotes ever achieved, which was legitimate youth hockey programs, just let that die out. What was the point? What was the point about that 28 years?
I mean, maybe there wasn't a point.
So the one funny thing about this saga is that apparently Alex Meruelo is going to get to own the Tucson Roadrunners, who are the AHL team.
Sure.
He's planning to move them to Mullet Arena.
Okay. And I hope they're still the Tucson.
My thing on this is that if that's going to happen... They have to renegotiate the affiliate agreements, and the Roadrunners should become the Carolina Hurricanes affiliate or something like that.
Well, they shouldn't become the Carolina Hurricanes affiliate.
Whoever.
They could...
Well, I used Carolina because they don't currently have an affiliate, but...
Oh, they don't?
No, they've played the whole season without an AHL team, but...
Well, that seems like a different podcast.
But my point on this is that if their plan is we're going to move Tucson to Tempe and play there, and we're going to host... the prospects of the team that just left. That sounds like a really bad idea to me.
Well, yes, it does.
Like, hey, do you remember these guys? They were going to play for your team. Now they play for a different team, but you still have to come and watch them.
I don't have a comment. At least a recordable comment on that. Anything else about the Utah Yeti Ski Patrol?
No, not really. I mean, it's the one thing that sucks is that for the few Coyotes fans that were diehards, number one, they are the greatest fans in the world. You stuck with this team for this many years. But it is they're kind of getting the Cleveland Browns experience or the Quebec Nordiques experience where you suffer through a long rebuild. And then just when it starts to look like we might have some players, and it's like, we're out. If you want to see the payoff, you have to watch them somewhere else, which is a bummer for them. But the league will be much better off going this route.
It just feels like
it will be better for everyone involved.
It feels like if you've been a Coyotes fan all of this time, like you either need something to do with your life, or if you're that much of a hockey fan, there are other NHL teams that you can watch and cheer for.
Exactly.
There are good organizations that play good hockey that are even close by. You could be a Vegas fan. You could be an Avs fan. You could be a Stars fan. I don't know. Those are all organizations that have had success and build decently well.
That's what's just driven me crazy about this is that there's been some talk of, oh, the players are upset about how this came so suddenly and they hadn't been in the loop. And I'm like, I do get that. If a business is going to be moving next week, you should tell the employees maybe a little before that. But on the same token, if you are a fan, an employee, a player, doesn't matter, and you're not acutely aware for the past 20 years that this team could be relocating at any time, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, there's a lot of people that are caught up in their own lives and are not aware of what's going on around them. So I think that could be the case. One of the things that was going on around us was not scoring any goals. So this might be the part of the segment and podcast that we move into talking about that. We'll see how long that lasts, because I don't think that
there's not a lot to say.
A ton. There are a few things. The one thing that we talked about was that, you know, Michigan, one of the talking points was that they needed to basically play a mistake-free game. And I want to make an argument here that, you know, I thought they played pretty well. I don't think that they played... This was not... I said that on the podcast on Sunday. This was not like the Quinnipiac game of 23. Or... Well, I don't want to get in the Denver game, but the game against Quinnipiac, they just kind of got really poor performances from a lot of people. I didn't think that Michigan played poorly. I thought that they played decently well, and then when they made a mistake, BC just killed them.
Yeah,
and then it happened again and again.
I wrote in the Hockey Weekly that's being posted some point.
Maybe. Depends.
It's getting delayed by new news, but... that it felt like Michigan played a B-level game, and the team they are playing against, who is a lot better than them, played an A-level game. And the result is that you lose pretty decisively.
And I think that going into this, if you would have said that, well, I think this is true not even just against Michigan, but when BC plays at an A or an A-plus level, no one's beating them.
Yep.
I mean, maybe if everything is fluky, but you're just going to need literally everything to go your way. And on that note, then that means that they probably weren't playing an A-plus level game because they were not getting any luck. So, we can... I do want to give Michigan credit that I do think that they did not play poorly. They just didn't play a perfect game, and BC did, and BC had a higher ceiling. So
and
that
BC
was,
got a little puck luck, too.
Yeah, they got a little bit. So one of the other point that we talked about was, you know, BC creating off the rush. Well...
They got a goal real quick.
Right away, there was a two-on-one, and it was two of the three or four players you would not want it to be. It was Will Smith and Ryan Leonard, and they came down after Casey got caught in the zone, and Truscott did not play that very well at all.
No, and it came after Michigan had a good first shift. They were in an offensive zone.
I think Casey actually hit the post.
I don't think he did, but he got a good look at the very least.
He was very close. I thought it deflected, but...
And so it was just sort of in 2 minutes, sort of like, well, this seems like...
And that's not on Barczewski. That's not a save that he should make.
One and the pass comes across. There's not a ton you can do, especially if you aren't like Andre Vasilevsky.
Right. You lunge and you hope that your glove hits it, and if it didn't...
If you're got long arms and are super athletic, maybe you can get it, but he's not. So it is what it is.
So it's 1-0, and, you know, Michigan, for the most part, for the rest of that period...
No, I thought they played a good first period. I thought they were battling.
Well, and they killed a penalty. I mean, like, Estapa took an insane penalty.
Yeah, it was so bad.
The puck's on the other side of the ice, and he decides to rock somebody into the boards. And you're like, well, now if they score, this could be over fast. And, you know, Michigan actually did a decent job. Well, they didn't have to kill this one because it became a 4-on-4, but they did get one later that they killed, and so you know, even a shorthanded chance. So the first period was pretty acceptable, and I thought at the end of that period, you know, even though they'd given up that rush goal, you know, they were still in the game and they were playing well enough that if they could get on the board or at least tie it, you thought, you know, they have a chance.
Yeah, I thought they came out of that period in an okay spot, and it was like, okay, keep battling, and maybe we can get a bounce and tie the game up, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
And, you know, they actually, you know, Barczewski did make a couple of big hero saves. You know, we talked about they're going to need an A-plus level performance from Barczewski, and in the end, that's not what he gave, but he did make some good saves, and had Michigan been able to get a puck in the net or get a bounce, you know, it may have gone the other way, but they weren't.
That one on the Leonard mini break was like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, well, he had two of those. He had one later that was similar to that as well. And, you know, Michigan got a second power play. Their first one was sort of split, but then their second one, they had a full power play, and they kept the puck in the zone. I thought they did pretty well. There's a lot of movement, but BC's penalty kill is 90% for a reason. And Michigan just never got a good shot. I think they got one chance that they went low to slot and got Nazer open in the slot, and he just missed it high and wide, and that was their real one chance. But you know, that was pretty much it. They also got one odd man rush slightly a little bit after that, a 4-on-2. But again, the puck falls to Luka of all the people that you're gonna have taking the chance, and his shot is deflected.
Yep.
And it goes wide, and, you know, so at halftime of the game, you know, or, you know, 10 minutes to go in the second period, you know, shots are 12-9 Michigan. They're suppressing BC, and they're creating a little bit. You know, I thought their top couple lines were all right on the forecheck and turning BC over in the zone. They never got a ton of grade A looks, but they got the puck away from the Eagles in their zone and had some chances on net. And I thought that they did better there than when they entered the zone and cycled.
Yeah, as a whole, this game kind of felt like pulling back the curtain of sorts on the BC underlying numbers. Just the, they don't like outshoot the opponent by a ton.
No.
And then you watch the game and it's kind of like, oh, this is why.
They don't have to.
Yeah, and they don't let the other team really get by the net.
Right, which is a big deal. So, you know, Michigan then gets their third power play chance, and you're like, okay, this is a chance.
It felt like a big moment.
But then Dylan Duke is called for a tripping penalty. It's argued that it was phantom. I wasn't as...
I mean, he does hit the guy.
Right.
And the guy falls over.
Right. I didn't necessarily think that it wasn't a trip, but it's been said. So at 4-on-4, this is where the puck luck for Boston College, as you're talking about, as Will Smith wraps around the net and sort of throws the puck in front, and Ethan Edwards is tying up his guy right in front of Barczewski, and it somehow hits Edwards' right skate and then his left skate and goes through Barczewski. And so it's 2-0 on just kind of a fluky little play. The one thing I will say is I don't really blame Edwards for this, because he's actually tying up his guy, and what are you going to do if a guy throws a puck off your skates? I don't love it from Barczewski, because it goes through his five holes. He's moving across, and you know, it is unlucky, but you know, as a goalie, you don't really want the puck to go through you. If it goes around you or above you or something like that, that is one thing, but you know, when you're moving, you'd prefer it not go between your legs.
Those are tough. The just sort of thrown in the crease and then a little pinball. I mean, the biggest thing I felt in that was just sort of like, it doesn't seem like it's happening. Like if this, right? Like it's
like after that, you're like, well,
we're down
probably
1-0. We've been battling. Can't quite get a bounce. And then you get a double deflection skate goal the other way. And it's like, eh.
Well, and
it doesn't feel like our night.
If that didn't convince you.
Yeah. And then you give up
right away.
Yep.
Right, Cutter Gauthier gets a breakaway, gets by Seamus Casey.
A very weird play with the was it?
I think one of the defensemen fell over
at the blue line.
Yeah, and Gauthier just rockets into the zone. No one's catching him, and just beats Barczewski. And
then it was like, oh, the game's over.
That was kind of what I felt, and you know, they had a couple of chances. I think Warren hit the post, and, you know, they had a couple of good looks, and Moldenauer had a good look from the low slot area. It went wide, and, you know, one if one of those goes in, you're kind of entertaining the thought, all right, well, we're one bounce away from being one bounce away, and but nothing really did. In the third period, I didn't have a ton of notes, because at that point, you're kind of like, well. But Barczewski did make a nice pad save on a breakaway on Leonard, and but then Perreault comes in, and, you know, Luka just doesn't really track him. And Perreault goes around him, and Barczewski sort of overcommits to the post, and Truscott can't get to the back post in time, and the puck is just sort of stuffed in, and Barczewski can't get back. I mean, you know, it's not great from Barczewski, but, like, also, I mean, Luka has to do something. Like, you can't just stand there, which is more or less what he did. And Truscott needs to get to the back post, which he doesn't do either. And so it's just sort of a, it felt a little bit like the Notre Dame game winner in St. Paul back in 2018, where there's like 5 seconds left and you get two defensemen, including Quinn Hughes and then Hayden Levine, that are all just not really engaged, and you get a 1-on-3 goal to lose right
that
before the end.
That was real bad.
Right, but that's sort of what this game felt like. Or not this game, this play. And sure. You just get a breakdown from both defensemen and the goaltender, and you're like, all right. I mean, they're probably checked out at that point. And then it's 4-0, and I mean, after that, it was all, well, this is what it is. Will they score? And the answer was no. So, you know, we can talk a little bit about some things. I think that what you saw in this game, and, you know, you had texted me a little bit and were saying, you know, BC's just a really sound, positionally aware defensive team.
Yeah.
And
that
you see that on the penalty kill and in the zone, and that's something that Michigan is not. And I think the thing that I'm going to let you explain this in a second, but they don't sacrifice their offense to do it. So it's sort of a narrative of like, well, you either do one or the other. And I'm not 100% convinced that you can't play good defense and also have a high-flying offense.
Yeah, I mean, I picked up their defense on the pre-scale because I was watching the Quinnipiac game over, and Quinnipiac scored 4 goals in that game. And I watched it, and I was like, I didn't really think BC was that bad really defensively in this game. They gave up 4 goals, but as I talked about previously, every one of them that they gave up was like a screenshot or like a rebound knockdown in front. There was one that bounced off the end boards perfectly to a guy on the far side. Like,
yep.
Their expected goals against in that game was probably like 2 or something like that, and it ended up being 4 because of some individual game bad bounces. But like, they didn't really give up any breakaways to Quinnipiac. They weren't really getting ripped apart by Quinnipiac, and I thought they used their sticks well. And then that was kind of borne out in this game, and then in the championship game that they don't win, but they, again, only gave up 2 goals in that game to another good offensive team. And this was, they were right near the top in goals against this season.
Well, yeah,
goal prevention. And
when you're plus 100, you're also not giving up
a
lot.
And I like Fowler, but like when I watched them play, I did think, yeah, Fowler's a good goalie, but he's not carrying this team on his back. Like, they really do a good job defending in their own zone. And so that's a piece of evidence. And obviously, we have last year's Minnesota team as another example of a good defensive team that also had top 5 picks, really creative scoring line sort of players. So it's entirely possible for you to be able to marry a high-scoring team with a good defensive team. And it's also possible to marry a young team with a good defensive team, because this BC team was the youngest in college hockey by average age in the College Hockey News metric. So
we can talk a little bit about the title game in the next segment, because there's, you know, some points to that, but I think that what you have to look at with Michigan is that they do the same thing poorly every year, and it's usually in-zone defense, it's penalty kill, that kind of thing. And regardless of how many goals they score or what their goal, how their goalie plays, those are two areas that they always seem to struggle with. And, you know, if you want to compete at this level and win these kinds of games, those are the areas of your team you need to shore up. It's not, can we get to goal 7? It's, can we prevent goal 4, sometimes 3? And that's
what's sort of been the frustrating thing about this, is that it's kind of a not to the same degree, because what Michigan does well, they do really well, and they've allowed themselves to have pretty good national success despite it. But it does have a little bit of feel of what we may discuss in our softball segment in the second half. But like the same story, right? Like when I follow a program and it's like the same thing is happening year after year after year, the same issue is popping up year after year. There are some things going on there, and it merits some examination of what the problem is. And I think when you look at this Michigan team, that's what I'm most interested in seeing Brandon Nerado figure out over the next few years. And this next class will be really his first recruiting class that are his guys, and then it will be borne out more and more as we get into 25 and 26. And that's what I'm curious to see, is how he constructs. Because we know what Mel Pearson constructed around, and we've seen that year over year. And it tended to be offensively minded, skilled, good skating defensemen who are undersized, and they had a little bit of an issue, I think, kind of filling in beneath their scoring defensemen.
Yeah.
That they would get these first-round pick, really talented offensive defensemen, which is fine. If you're going to be a top-tier offensive team like Michigan wants to be, you got to have one of them.
Now you have to. Yeah, that's just part of the game.
There's nothing wrong with that. But the issue has tended to be what fills out number 3 through 6 on the defensive chart.
Yeah.
And those have tended to be players that just don't really have any NHL interest at all. And they tended to not really be like really good college players either. I mean, the closest Michigan got was the defense a couple years ago in the super year.
Yeah.
When you had Power and Hughes as blue chippers. You had Truscott and Edwards who were drafted. You had Blankenberg who was a legitimate UDFA and a four-year college player. That's about as good as they've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
But like you look at this year's team, and like, no offense to some of the pieces, but
it's our job to talk about it.
Yeah, your Steve Holtz's and your Luca Fantilli's and those sorts of players just would not necessarily be in the lineup for your BCs and Minnesota's. And I think we look at this BC team. They had six defensemen in the lineup, or when they drafted seven, then they would have five drafted out of the seven they dressed. And the two who were undrafted were a senior and a sophomore. And I feel like that's, and they didn't have the blue chip first rounder, but all the guys that were drafted between the third and fourth round in like the 100 range. They had a good mix of two freshmen, one junior, one sophomore, and two seniors among their top six. In Minnesota, we saw a similar story with four guys in like that late first to early second range, and a lot of them got to the junior year. That's what you kind of want, like a good mix of some freshmen, some sophomores, some juniors, some seniors, a good mix of some blue chips, some older veteran players, and a nice amount from that juicy mid-round range, second, third, fourth round.
Right.
And then you also want to have a mix of different sizes. And you look at this BC defensive core, like it's not you're never in college hockey gonna get our top pair is Victor Hedman and Jan Ruda, you know. The lowest weight of those two is 235 pounds. Like, you're just not gonna get that in college hockey. But BC was icing a roster with 6'3", 6'2", 5'10", 5'11", 6'1", 5'11", 5'11",
and 5'11" is fine.
It's fine. That's college hockey, pretty normal.
Yeah.
And Michigan's just tended to have, I mean, this year with between Tyler Duke and Seamus Casey, two very, very small defensemen.
And that's part of the problem with playing them together, is that, you know, while I think Tyler was pretty good in his own zone and as a good player, he was also just small. And you put him with Seamus Casey and you get out against the wrong line, and like all of a sudden, you know, what did Charles Barkley always say, you know, in the post? Is like, you're just shooting over chairs. Like, there's no one can block your shot. And that's, you just got a little guy, you put him on your back and you back him down and you got space and rebounds and it's just tough to do anything. And that just has happened too much. And like, you know, we see the transformation of Marshall Warren in the last month and a half or so, and he's become a nice player and he's a bigger body. And that was one of the reasons why the team had success. The other thing is like, you needed that from Steve Holtz and you needed that from Jacob Truscott a lot. And that both of those players were very inconsistent. I mean, you know, Luka was probably always the seventh or eighth defenseman on the team, and that's fine. But you just didn't get the depth of quality defensemen. And then, you know, maybe the one good pair that you had was very undersized and not great in your offensive zone. I mean, everyone's going to want a Seamus Casey, and I want Seamus Casey back next year, and I'll always take a player like that. But like you said, you can't have three of them. You can't have five of them.
Yeah, it's the. I just that's the thing I want to see Nerado improve on over the next few years as he gets his guys in here. It's just a healthier mix of NHL talent and a healthier mix of experience, a healthier mix of sizes that give you different options.
And Denver played really good defense.
Denver was
against,
awesome defense.
Well, I'm not even talking about this year. In 2022, yeah. When they beat Michigan.
Yeah.
And Quinnipiac was really good defensively. And Minnesota last year, the two teams that made the title game. BC was good defensively. Denver was very good defensively this year. Like you mentioned, look, when the Avs won the Cup, a lot of it was because their defense was very good and their defensemen played well and they backchecked. And when Vegas won last year, they had like a very strong structure that they shut down offensive guys like Tkachuk and the Panthers. So you look around at teams that hang banners and win championships in hockey, and it's fun to score goals and you should score goals, but you can't be neglectful on the back end, and you have to be very good back there too, or else those games are going to get you. I mean, they gave up Michigan gave up three to Denver 2 years ago. They gave up, what, five to Quinnipiac last year?
With an empty net, it was really four.
Four, whatever. And they gave up four to BC. I mean, how many of those games do you think you're winning if you know how many goals the opponent's getting? Like, maybe they have a shot against Denver. But you're not thinking, oh, we're going to go hang five on Parrots against Quinnipiac, or five on BC.
Well, and the frozen four is to some degree random in small sample sizes. I think this in... what it definitely addresses is why Michigan can never win the Big Ten in the regular season.
Well, that's...
is that when you spend the entire first half of the season...
with...
trying to look for answers in the defensive
67%
end,
on the PK.
Yeah, like it's... so that's going to be the big challenge in the long term.
And I think that it's important that they continue to recruit players that score goals, and it's fine to play an open system. But you do need, I mean, we saw BC do that at times, but and they scored a lot of goals, but they also prevented goals. And that is something that I think that I've taken away from this Frozen Four as much as any, as you look at the other teams, and they were all really good defensively. And Michigan played better defensively down the stretch, and that's why I think they got there. But I would not call that like a hallmark of this year's team. It was something that they cleaned up late. Because, I mean, like, you look at where we were on February 17th, you know, after that game in Hockey Valley, and you're like, I mean, this team's probably not going to the tournament. Because, I mean, they can't break down certain things, and they give up too many goals.
They came a long way over the course of this year, but it would be nice to...
not wait till February to figure those things out in the future?
Yeah, on a regular basis.
Yeah, I would agree. So, I don't know. Overall takes, I think that this is... Michigan had a good year. I think they're going to be disappointed that they didn't beat BC or win a second game in St. Paul, and that's what a good competitor should feel like. But I think that objectively watching the first semifinal and the second semifinal and then pieces of the final game, I think it was clear that Michigan was the fourth best team there. And...
which feels right.
And it's probably right. You're right. And, you know, they probably were not the fourth best team throughout a lot of the year, but played well enough in the last month plus and got there. And that's something to be proud of, and that's something to take into next year. But if you want to start aiming higher, the things that we talked about do need to be addressed, and they can't be addressed in February. They need to be how your team is built and who they are.
I can't believe I'm doing this. If you find yourself in the penalty box, you want a Michigan man arguing your case, call criminal law attorney and former prosecutor Jonathan Paul tonight. It's 248 and 924-9458. Or visit his old website at MichiganLawGrad.com.
Mr. Blue, I told you that I love you. Please believe me. Mr. Blue, I have to go now, darling. Don't be angry. Know that you're tired. Know that you're sore inside. sick inside for some reason. So I'll leave you with a smile, kiss you on the cheek, and you will call it treason. Well, that's the way it goes some days. A fever comes at you without a warning, and I can see it in your face. You've been waiting to break since you woke up this morning, Mr. Blue. Don't hold your head so low that you can't see the sky, Mr. Blue. It ain't so long since you were flying high.
Well, for the third year in a row, we do not have a game specifically to talk about in the second segment of this particular podcast, which is a bummer for sure. We will talk a little bit about the title game. I didn't watch a ton of it. You probably watched a little bit more.
Probably not.
I bet you watched more than I did.
Did you see Zero?
About that, yeah.
But I saw maybe 10%. So.
Wow, you're up on me. I did look at some of the things and some of the stats, and the thing that jumped out to me was that BC once again had, what, like 12 shots, something like that, in the first two periods. And, you know, that's, you know, like you said, maybe it's a little bit more of how they play, but Denver, you know, didn't give up a lot of chances early on or in the first two periods and sort of kept the game close, and then got a really good performance out of their goalie in the third period as BC cranked it up and got 23 shots, I think. So, you know, that's just sort of reinforces a little bit of what we were talking about, is you have to be able to play good defense and then know that the other team is going to ramp it up. And then they got an A-plus performance out of their goalie. And, you know, that's just what it takes. Like, you don't get to have a mid-level goalie performance, a mid-level defensive performance, offensive performance, and win national titles. I mean, was it going to take a subpar effort to beat Alabama for Michigan in the Rose Bowl? No, they needed to play a great game, and they did, and the same thing against Washington. And they did, and that's how you do it. And Michigan gave a good performance, not a great performance. I think that's something like similar to that Nerado said. And Denver gave two great performances, and that's how you beat a team like BC.
It's also just sort of another example of the hokiness of the NCAA tournament.
Well, sure, but
because it's like, oh, our goalie just blacked out for like a couple weeks, and now we won the national championship.
But I think that Denver is not, they probably over the course of the season were not as good as BC, but they weren't far off.
The point that is worth pointing out is that Denver did beat BC already in the regular season.
They did.
The series,
it was very early.
The series is 2-0, and Denver's heading back home for game 3. So,
well, if it's a 3-game series, it's probably over.
But if you're looking for hopium, the stats for Matt Davis in the USHL were pretty similar to Cameron Corpy's.
Yeah.
So,
well, so
file that away.
In 3 years.
In 3 years, we're in business.
Good luck the next two.
I mean, Denver's a good team.
Yeah,
their goalie was incredible on that particular day, and they won because of it.
But that's the thing as well, and it sort of builds on the thing we talked about earlier, is that Denver had a powerful offense, but you know what else they did? Played defense.
No, they didn't.
Got good goaltending.
And their forwards weren't, they didn't do a ton in the
no, because you're
the tournament, and the goalie and the defense did their job, and now we wait to see if David Carl is hired this offseason.
Which you're hoping he is.
It would be nice, except, I mean, they'll probably just regenerate a new coach.
I mean, didn't they have another good one? Was it Montgomery?
Jim Montgomery was the guy before.
Yeah, so, okay. Control-C, Control-V. how it goes when you have a good program. You go make a good hire, and you transition on to the next guy, and he does things.
I'll say that Ziv Buyum, pretty good player. I think somebody.
Where's he going to go?
He had been in like the 10 to 15 range. He might be rising up because of this performance.
Somebody on Twitter said, if you can tell me 10 guys that are definitively better than him in this draft, I'll let you do it.
But, yeah, he's got a case.
Yeah.
I mean,
who's his comp?
I don't know. I haven't seen him enough, but from what I saw, he looked pretty good.
Yeah. Any more that you have on the title game?
Denver now holds the most national titles.
They do.
Congrats to them.
Michigan
don't really care about that.
You don't? Why not?
A lot of this is from like a long time ago or whatever. I also don't, I mean.
But you're a history guy.
I don't really respect the NCAA tournament, you know that.
Well, okay. I give you that. I mean, we both have our issues with the NCAA tournament, but like, I don't know. It feels like when you're rooting for this stuff and the reason you're watching it is hanging banners, and if someone else is doing it, you want to be doing it.
Yeah, it would be nice to win one one day.
Now you sound like a Mets fan.
Pistons fan.
Pistons have won one in the last 20 years. Get out of here.
Barely.
Barely. They've won three in my lifetime. So you're... No. I'm muting you. You can keep talking, but I'm going to hit the mute button on that, on the Pistons.
In the last 20 years, we've got 8 more months, if that's true. And then it will expire. But
okay. 21 years then. It's going to be extended by a year. You wanted to talk a little bit about some of the NHL award races last week, and, well, that didn't work. So, what award are you wanting to discuss?
We're down to the end for the Hart Trophy, league MVP.
And that isn't, like...
This is the most interesting
definitive,
Hart race of a long, long time. It's rarely ever been this interesting.
It sounds like a 5K or something, right?
Isn't that... The Hart race.
The Hart race, yeah.
So we've got... I would say 4 candidates. Maybe you can make it 5 or something.
Who is your 5th?
I think there's a big 4, and then you can make compelling cases for Artemi Panarin, Quinn Hughes, and David Pastrnak. And so honestly, Connor Hellebuyck, if you wanted to, too.
So
I'd
it's
hear
a
that
big 8?
There's a lot of guys that have had awesome seasons.
All right. We'll cut those guys out because you wouldn't just give me one. So give me the top 4.
Top 4. We have Nikita Kucherov.
Mm-hmm. Who's scoring?
His case is that he's probably going to win the scoring title. He's 3 points up, and he's got 2 games to play where the other guy has 1 game to play. So he's probably going to win his second scoring title. He might get to 100 assists, which is extremely rare. McDavid may get there as well. Only 3 players in history have ever gotten there. Mario Lemieux, Bobby Orr, and Wayne Gretzky. So that's a pretty cool club to be a part of.
Uh-huh.
And it's only happened about 12 times, and like 9 of them are Gretzky seasons. So
so those all kind of blend together at a certain point.
So it's that would be pretty cool. And you've got the fact that Kucherov is something like 50 points higher in scoring than anyone else on his team.
No one on his team is scoring except him, right?
Well, the guys he passes to, and that's it. Well, like Point and Stamkos both have 40 goals, and then it's a sharp drop-off after that. And obviously Tampa being a wild card team, like he's really dragged that team.
Yeah.
So good case there. McKinnon is 3 points behind Kucherov. His case hinges on him having 8 more goals than Kucherov. And if points are similar, goals are inherently more valuable than assists. Also, while McKinnon is not really known as like a two-way monster, he's adding more defensive value than Kucherov because basically anyone is.
Because you are.
So he's got that going for him. He's also got the Career Achievement Award kind of going for him because he's been a runner-up 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
And it feels like he deserves one at some point, whereas all 3 other guys in the Big Four have won it. So
doesn't he have an insane like 5-on-5 numbers thing too?
The one sort of counter-argument for him, and this one applies for McDavid, is that if you sort of chart like analytically their quality of teammates, it's really high because the way those teams are coached, they're coached so that they put all the best players on the ice at the same time.
Sure.
So like...
which kind of makes sense.
Right. It's just, it's a little different than how Kucherov does and especially Matthews does. In that those, like Matthews plays a lot of shifts with like Ilya Lyubushkin or whoever, right?
Whereas
McKinnon, they pair the Makar pair with the McKinnon line so much.
Sure.
And the Oilers do that with the Bouchard-Ekholm pair. So
that's
one thing to keep in mind. McDavid... 130 points, a little behind the others, but he's played a few fewer games. His big argument was the 100 assist thing, but if Kucherov gets there too, that kind of
negates it
a little bit, and his injury here in the last week has kind of slowed his case.
Yeah.
The counter argument to him is in part voter fatigue. Like we saw this with Michael Jordan back in the day.
Yeah, at some point you're going to give an MVP to somebody else.
Yeah, people are just tired of him.
Yeah.
So that's... his
well,
case,
and especially in a situation where it's close. Like, if he was so far ahead, you're like, well, okay. But
And the downside for him is that he scored a lot fewer goals than anyone else in this race.
Yeah.
So that's also something to keep in mind. And then finally, we have Austin Matthews, whose case is interesting. He is sitting at 69 goals, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And
will he get one more?
Probably.
Yeah.
He's shooting a ton these last years.
is he shooting more than Ovechkin?
And nobody's gotten to 69 goals since 1996. It's an extremely exclusive club to get to 69, let alone 70. He's got something like 13 more goals than anyone else in the NHL, which is a huge gap, historically speaking, between one and two. And then he's got the case of being the best defensive player of this group. He does not kill penalties, but if you watch him play, very, very good takeaways. I mean, he's a master with the stick and picking people's pockets. The downside for him, and this is really the death knell to probably his case, is that his line mates don't shoot the puck in the net.
They shoot at other places?
He's got 38 assists, which is not very many, and it's not really because of anything related to him. He has a lot of primary assists, and so his primary point totals are very similar to Kucherov and McKinnon. Problem is, he has very few secondary assists.
Because nobody can score.
So, like, Matthew Nye's just not shooting it in the net when he's supposed to. And that's...
But he's playing with Marner.
He played with Marner some of the year. Okay. Marner's been hurt for a little while, but Marner's also a passer. But typically, Matthew's ratio of goals to assists is about like 1 to 0.8 or something like that. And so if he had a regular ratio, he'd be at maybe 55 assists. And his point total then would be in the ballpark of the other guys. And thus, I think his case would be quite strong. But unfortunately, few secondary assists. The voters don't know puck, unfortunately.
Don't know puck.
And he's a little behind, but...
Who's the biggest power play merchant of the four?
Oh, Kucherov. Definitely. Yeah.
Does that go against him or not really?
Possibly. He's also an empty net merchant a little bit, which...
They put him out there when the net's empty?
Yeah, we used to have these arguments a lot with Scheifele and Kyle Connor used to be the big empty net villains in the analytics circles. And Kucherov's got a ton of empty net points this year. Okay. So my guess is McKinnon will win, but it's crazy. It's crazy that you could have... Two separate players get to 100 assists. One guy gets to 70 goals. And then one guy who is not any of those three win the MVP. Like, this is...
Wasn't somebody talking...
In so many years, any one of these four would win it.
Wasn't somebody talking about how, like, Crosby should be considered...
I think Crosby's got an argument because he's kind of dragged this corpse of the Pittsburgh Penguins. I think Pasternak's got a great case because... You look at the center he plays with, you look at the other wingers he plays with, and it's like he's going to hit 50 goals again. Like, Lord. Panarin is going to get 120 points. And, like, again, in so many years of the past 15
this
years,
would be...
that's like an auto MVP. And it's like, oh, he's doing that?
Oh, I didn't even know because of the first 8 storylines you're telling. Yeah,
He's been really good. I think you could make a case for Quinn Hughes, who's over 90 points and who I think has been one of the singular biggest reasons for Vancouver's turnaround. I think you can say the same thing for Connor Hellebuyck, who's by far and away the best goalie in the league, and
it's
hard to imagine what Winnipeg would be
without him, but they weren't. But he's made them,
So it's a great field. It's a great field, and it's...
Is there any other awards that you wanted to get into, or not really?
Not really. It's... the other one that I guess you could make interesting cases for is a coach of the year, the Jack Adams. My guess is that Rick Tocchet of the Canucks will win. Tortorella had a good case for a while, and then his goalies just stopped making any saves about a month ago. But they could still back
him. One of them was hauled off, so...
Well, yeah, when he left, then the other guys were like, oh, well, we're done.
Well, what about the guy in Dallas or Winnipeg?
I think Winnipeg has got a good case.
Bonus?
Bonus, yeah. They've had a great season. He's done good work with their defense. I think you could make a case for... Jim Montgomery in Boston again. I mean, he won it last year, so he won't again, but they've had a great season relative to expectations.
But this is a different, really good season than last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Andrew Brunette in Nashville, I mean, I didn't really think much of them, and they've had a good year. And that's an impressive job. The one guy I don't want to see in discussion is Spencer Carberry for the Capitals, who I don't think is a bad coach. But I've seen the buzz because Washington could slip into the playoffs. But, like, come on now.
What about the guy in Florida?
You can't win the Jack Adams when your team has a minus 40 goal difference. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry.
Paul Maurice?
Yeah, I think he'd have a case. He's improved them quite a bit and has coached them well. There's a lot of good coaches, and there isn't like an obvious slam dunk, but I think that probably Tockett's just got the best case because this was not a team a lot of people expected to be very good, and they're going to win the Pacific. I mean, they need one more point to do that, which they'll probably get tonight or tomorrow against Calgary, but I think that's the most cohesive case, right? Like, I'm coaching a team that hasn't been any good in like 10 years, and now we won a tough division. So I think that's like the best argument for him. But
okay. So that's a quick rundown on a couple, at least, NHL award races. And then you have been begging me and pleading and sending letters to Santa so that we can talk about softball on the HockeyCast. So I believe, you know,
we could talk about baseball first if you wanted to get anything out there.
All the negatives of that.
They're a weird team because
they're about what? They're slightly below 500.
They're 17-20, I believe. I just had the baseball standings.
Well, they took two or three against what? A bad Minnesota team.
They're good in the Big Ten play.
Okay, what's their Big Ten record?
They're 8-4 in the Big Ten, and they're towards the top.
Have they played any of the other contenders? Are there contenders in the Big Ten, or is everyone just a pretender?
I'm not up on the Big Ten baseball too much, but Illinois is 7-2, Nebraska is 6-3, Michigan is 8-4, Purdue is 8-4, Indiana is 5-4, Ohio State's 5-4.
So they're still have a chance to win the Big Ten
because
or
all the
make
teams
the tournament
that they're tied with in the Big Ten.
Well,
are
the Big Ten tournament.
Are like way above them in their overall record.
Yeah.
And the big reason for this is that Michigan has a very small number of usable pitchers. And so they pitched them on the weekend. And as it's turned out, they're able to consistently win on the weekend. They've taken two of three, I think, every series they've played so far. And then they get in the midweek games against Oakland.
They've
and
lost.
Just give up like 20 runs because the pitchers...
Because they're not going to burn them then.
Yeah, the pitchers who can't pitch are pitching in those midweek
games.
So
the differential between their top few pitchers and everyone
else...
Yeah,
I mean, they got run-ruled by EMU on March 19th, but then they run-ruled EMU a couple weeks later, so they got revenge at least. But
you know, always getting revenge on Easter, and that's high on our
list.
They
lost to Western 10-9 a couple weeks ago, or last week,
well,
rather.
Well, I just remember what the first couple games of the season they played Western in like Arizona or some faraway place, and
they
were
with Western, but they lost the first two 14-13, 11-9.
And I after that I was like, well, all of a sudden my expectations for anything of this baseball team have a bit cratered when you're gonna have your first two starters not be able to hold a team under 10.
It is a major retool.
I don't think anyone thought that this team was going to be elite by any means, but like I still would say that a 14-13 college baseball game is unwatchable.
It's not great. But, you know, if this is a young team, a lot of new players, a lot of new faces.
Yeah.
If they can stay towards the top of the Big Ten, you know, finish with a above 500 record in conference play and make the Big Ten tournament, I think that's a decent
That's
while you're still trying to rebuild the program.
That's fine because it looks like they found some younger players. I mean, Mitch Voigt's having a nice year, at least hitting. Doesn't he have like 7 or 8 home runs?
Yeah, his pitching I think has regressed a little bit, but
he had won a nice game this weekend, I thought. He pitched a second game.
Yeah, Kurt Parr's been a good pitcher for them as well. They've got a couple guys and they're able to just kind of cobble it together.
Denner's been
he's been better recently.
Pitchable.
Yeah. So
sort of. So there's something there.
Yeah,
maybe.
We'll see how the season keeps going, but and then in softball,
this is your baby. You and Craig. Where's Craig?
He's in a different room.
Okay. We should have brought him in on this.
It's a pretty remarkable kind of season of sorts because those of us that have followed the softball team week in and week out over many seasons, or just people with a vague,
or people within earshot of you.
People with a vague sense of the softball team or have read any of my pieces have known the basic gist with this team for a while. And it's that for many, many years running, they could not hit.
Yeah, basically since Sierra Romero.
Pretty much. The next year, they could still a little bit because they still had Kelly Christner. And then another year after that, they still had Tara Blanco. But like slowly as the last pieces from the 15-16 teams got culled off the roster,
yeah,
the hitting went downhill, and pretty sharply. And their, like, 2019-2020 recruiting classes really did not pan out from an offensive standpoint. And so it led to the end of the Hutchins era, and she retired. And then you brought in Bonnie Foal, and last year the hitting was as bad as it's ever been. And so you go into this season, and it's kind of like, well, see what happens, I guess.
Were you high on this team?
I didn't know what to expect. Yeah. I didn't feel great, especially I show up on softball media, you know, the Zoom call for the media conference. And
yeah.
It's like, and Bonnie's like, well, I don't anticipate that we're going to be a big power team this year. And I'm like, no!
Did you just log off?
Wait,
where's Alex?
Throwing the laptop out the window.
He's gone after hearing that comment.
But, and I understand the circumstances and why Bonnie was hired and all that stuff. And so even though I was preferring to go outside the program, just because I felt that in general, when things are going downhill and then you promote an assistant, it just sort of feels like,
well,
if the assistant had the answer, wouldn't they have told the team? But
the problem with that is that is the outgoing coach bigger than the program? And it sort of felt a little bit like that with Hutchins, and it felt a little bit like that with Red.
Yeah.
And at some point, like, you have to say, hey, what I've built here and turned into this national success is more important than what I want or what anyone wants, because the program is the program. And a lot of times that gets lost. And, you know, Brian says a couple times, well, you get to name your successor. And it's like,
it's kind of the Bo Ryan Wisconsin.
I mean, are we just,
because she waited until August, late August, to step down, like until players were on campus.
Yeah.
And it put them in a really hard spot, and I get all that. But I kind of felt coming into this season, it just sort of felt like, man, I don't know if this is happening. But if it is going to happen, it needs to happen now.
So
we need to see returns this season, or else it just sort of feels like this is what it is, as long as this sort of regime is there. And plus, if we used the thought process that the culprit was something related to Carol Hutchins in the hitting department, that it might take a year or two to install a new plate approach, get new assistants, and that kind of thing. And so they elevated Faith Canfield to assistant coach for last season. They hired Amanda Chidster for last season as well. So that's two players that were great hitters once upon a time. And so this was the start of the period where you needed to start seeing results. And through 1 month of the season, the results were not there. They were 11-10 on the season. They had made it to the Judy Garman Classic, which is a really tough tournament. They're playing good teams.
Mm-hmm.
They lose the first four games of that tournament. 6-0, 5-1, 1-0, 10-0. They scored one run in 27 innings of softball. And this was after having lost to Louisville 2-0 and FAU 1-0. And I'm just sort of sitting there like, I don't know. This feels really bad.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, that last game of that tournament, they played Florida, who they did actually beat early in the season. But they beat them 2-1 in 10 innings. So like the classic Michigan softball game of the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this time they beat Florida 10-2. In a run rule. And it's like, oh, wow, that came out of nowhere. And then from there, they started migrating north. They played two tournaments in Kentucky, and they started putting up more runs, started scoring four, you know, more often. And then they made it back to Ann Arbor. And over the past few weeks, dating back to mid-March, they've started just pounding the ball. And so they beat Purdue, who's pretty bad. Okay.
They swept them, didn't they?
Yep. They score 7, 11, and 6 in three games. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go into Bloomington. And Indiana, before that game, had a pitching staff ranked around 50th nationally. So not bad.
Okay.
There's 300-some teams.
Yeah.
So that's a decent. They put up 15, 7, and 10 in those three games.
It's pretty good.
So you're like, okay.
Now what'd they give up?
6, 1, and 1 in those three
games. So they won.
So they swept that series.
Comfortably.
Yep.
All right.
And so that's when I wrote the softball piece that I published 2 weeks ago. And I was like, there are some good signs here. But these next 2 weekends against Northwestern and Iowa are a big test. Because Northwestern and Iowa have good pitching staffs. And
they went to Evanston.
They did not win any games because the pitching went south on their end, which that's a different story. But I'm just focused on the hitting right now. They put up 1 in the first game, not great. But then they put up 5-4 in the next 2 games.
Acceptable.
And when you look at Northwestern's season, when they lose games, they usually lose 2-0 or like 1-0. Like they don't hit a lot. So when you if you had told me going to that series they're going to get 5-4 in 2 of the games, I say they win at least 1, if not 2. And it's disappointing the pitching let them down, but I felt like coming out of that, I was like, okay, that showed that they're not just going to get shut out against really good pitch.
Yeah.
They put up 11 against MSU last week, midweek, 5 against CMU. Then they bring Iowa to town. Iowa had
And they win that MSU and CMU games. Yep. Okay.
They bring Iowa to town. Iowa had given up more than 5 runs 4 times all season coming in. And Michigan put up more than 5 in all 3 games. They put up 8, 9, and 6. And the pitching totally deserts them in those first 2 games. They're down 5-0 before you can blink in game 1. They're down 8-1 in the 5th inning of game 5. And they rally to win both games. They get 2 walk-offs, and it's pretty remarkable. The last 19 games, they've hit 34 home runs. They hit, let me pull up the numbers here, but I was charting the home runs per season. And it's,
going back how long?
Back to 2018.
Okay, so you're looking at about 6-7 seasons there.
Yeah.
All right.
They hit 25 homers total last season in 51 games.
That seems like not many.
They hit 36 total in 56 games 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they've hit almost as many in the last 19 games as they hit that entire season. 40 in 2021 in 46 games. 56 in 58 in 2019. 44 in 57 in 2018. And 54 in 57 in 2017. So this sort of rate of home runs they've hit recently is totally beyond all of that.
Yeah.
And now for the season, they're up to 45 homers in 43 games. They've got 10 more in the regular season to play. There's a chance that despite hitting like basically 0 home runs for the first month of the season, they will hit the most home runs they've hit since Ciro Romero left across a full season.
Yeah, I mean, there's a non-zero chance that they push 60.
Yeah, if they keep hitting at this rate.
Yeah, I mean, they probably won't, but... I mean, like, it's on the table.
They do have Ohio State coming in at the end of the season, and they're a really bad pitching team. So that's like an opportunity to keep piling it up. And so I think overall, what is interesting about this is that, yeah, they're not doing this against Florida State and UCLA and Oklahoma. But at the same time, some of these teams they faced, like Iowa, was a decent pitching team. Like, they're definitely not a Women's College World Series pitching outfit, but they can pitch to some degree. And when you're doing that, that raises the eyebrows. And I have followed this team long enough to not be fooled by offensive explosions. Like, I remember a game I called a few years, maybe 2019, where it was, we won like 24-2 because Toledo couldn't throw the ball over the plate. Like, I've seen individual games like that. I've seen individual weekends where Rutgers comes to town and they get battered. But something like this that's sustained over weeks and weeks of games is something I haven't seen in a long time.
In a while, yeah.
And what's most encouraging about it for me is that it isn't one hitter, it isn't two hitters. It's a lot of hitters that are hitting well, and a lot of hitters that are young hitters hitting well. And that's what's legitimately exciting about it, because you know, you get this Ava Costales, who was a true freshman, didn't play much the first month. She comes in this week, about a month ago, and starts really hitting. This past weekend, she hit 3 home runs in the series, including a huge 3-run shot in the 6th inning of the game on Sunday. So it's just players like that. Janissa Conway is a true freshman. Maddie Erickson is a sophomore who didn't play a lot last year. Lily Valamont is a redshirt freshman who missed last year with injuries. It's these kinds of players. And all of them except Kiki Thole are either juniors or younger. And Kiki does have a COVID shirt. So if she wanted to help her aunt out, she could come back next year. But they've also got a couple recruits for next season that look like pretty good power hitters. And so it just feels like for the first time in a long time, they have a nucleus of a team that could, over a period of time, grow into...
iron some things out with the pitching, and maybe you have something.
Yeah, and the pitching is a little frustrating because Lauren Dukowski is maybe not Alex Starocco or Megan Bobian, but last year she was a pretty solid pitcher.
Yeah.
And this year, through the first month, when she was facing good teams, she was a pretty solid pitcher. She had a 1.5 ERA or something for quite a while. Last few weeks, it's really gotten off track, and that's bad because they don't really have a great number two option, and their ability to win games is going to be severely limited if they can't get her performing. But even if it doesn't come around, what I care about is the hitting side, because I trust Jen Brundage. She's established a long track record. They've got some really good pitching recruits for next season. They could always go in the portal. I trust that year over year, they'll figure the pitching out, even if it's in a little slump right now.
So where
it's the hitting that needs to grow, and to see a young team with young hitters getting better each week is really exciting.
So where do you see this team finishing in the Big Ten?
Well, they are 9-3 in the Big Ten right now.
With their three losses to one
Northwestern.
Team.
And again, that's frustrating because they
would have liked to get one of
at
those.
At least, yeah. They've got Penn State and Nebraska who are also, sorry, they're 10-3 in the Big Ten. Penn State's 9-3 and Nebraska's 8-3. They play Penn State and Nebraska the next 2 weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So those are going to be big games to determine the top of the Big Ten. And then they finish with 3-9 Ohio State.
So there's only three series left?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's one more midweek game against MSU, who's mm-hmm. really bad. Mm-hmm. So I think you, unless the pitching is just completely cooked, you would expect this team to do pretty well in those 10 games
mm-hmm.
because they've shown they can handle Big Ten teams.
Winning at least, hopefully, 7-8, something.
Ideally. And so you could finish in the top few of the Big Ten. I don't know the exact tournament picture. I'm waiting for the RPI to update. They bled so many games early in the year
yeah.
that it's going to be a bit of a challenge, but the Big Ten usually gets two or three or four in. And if they prove over the rest of the season into the Big Ten tournament that we are clearly the number two team in the Big Ten or clearly the number three team in the Big Ten, you do have two wins over Florida. That might be enough to get you in, even
just
if you don't
you
win the Big Ten.
As like a three seed or something.
Yeah, and that would be fine with me.
Yeah.
Because I would like this team to get in just because it would be good for the young hitters to get some experience. And also, but even beyond that, it's for me, it is identifying progress
yeah.
in this area of a program that's lacked for a long time.
Well, there's
time.
Just different checkpoints that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And getting back to the tournament for a team that has been, you know, stalwart for years and years and then drops off is sort of the first step in getting back to being somewhat relevant.
Yeah. And so it's an exciting time, and they're playing well, and it's, again, even if the pitching doesn't come around, I will so gladly take this trade-off for my sanity, because...
We all want you to have your sanity, Alex.
I just cannot take any more of 1-0 and 2-1 losses. Like, it's... To sit there this weekend and see a team rally from 5-6-7 down against real pitching teams is like... What is this?
Remember when this was fun?
We have not seen this in a long time.
So the last thing that we need to just kind of get out there is this news has sort of trickled in throughout the day, but we do have some news about Michigan players, Michigan hockey players, and it is that Frank Naser has left. That was over the weekend. He played his first game for the Blackhawks and scored on, his first shot.
It was a breakaway.
10 minutes into the game. So Frank will not be on the team next year. Gavin Brindley has also followed suit and I don't know if he'll be on the Blue Jackets, but he will not be playing for Michigan next year as he signed his pro deal. And the one that was a little more, not surprising, but a little kind of caught me off guard a little bit was Dylan Duke. I kind of thought he seemed like a program sort of 4-year guy and potential captain, but he is signed with the Lightning, and they're in a position where, you know, they're going to need contracts like his, and he's a tough, scrappy guy who scored 25 goals and improved on his passing over his career here, and, you know, he's becoming more of a complete hockey player. So in some regards, it's not surprising, but he was not probably the highest on my list. The one positive is that it sounds like Rutger McGroarty is going to come back. I guess if you would have said one guy's leaving, he would have been the guy I would have said is leaving. But
it was a big surprise in the way this all went.
I mean, he could probably be the captain next year.
I would assume he is.
As a junior. So he will be back. And so I guess we're kind of, you know, to some degree still waiting on Casey. It feels like Edwards is going to come back. I'm not sure what he's leaving on, but that remains to be seen. And then the last bit is that they did get a goalie in the portal already. His name is Logan Stein. He was at Ferris State, had okay numbers last year, but was at Ferris State. So it doesn't, you know, they're bringing in Cam Corby. All this stuff we will talk more in depth about next week when we do team and player grades, and the following week when we wrap up the hockey cast for the season and talk about what it looks like the team will be next year, or at least what our picture is of it near the end of April. But that is the news bits for this week. So not the podcast we were hoping to have, but unfortunately one we've been a bit accustomed to having.
Listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 6.24 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Next week will be a more focused podcast with more explicitly Michigan hockey details.